Hey, welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas, and I'm flying solo today. I shouldn't say solo. I got my pals Tina Knoll here. She's our producer here at LARJ Media.
Yep.
And the original voice of Radio Disney right there from Dallas, Texas, Tina Knoll.
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the show. I'm Tom Douglas, chef owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including the Lola, the Dahlia Lounge, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary on November 15th.
Wow.
We have a special dedication that night. One of my longest-term employees and co-workers, because we were co-workers together at Cafe Sport.
Wow.
We both came to Dahlia after that, so we've been working together for almost 40 years. Shelley Lance, who developed the coconut cream pie, the triple coconut cream pie, is ready to retire, and we've decided that this is a surprise. She doesn't know this. I hope she's not listening to me. We're going to honor her at the November 15th Dahlia Lounge 30th anniversary party.
Wow.
And have a little coconut cream pie month for the whole month of November. $6 for a piece of coconut cream pie, half price.
Oh, that's a steal.
And so that'll be fun starting November 1st, but it'll be an honor of her after her long-term cooking career.
She's co-author of some of your cookbooks as well, right?
All four cookbooks she co-wrote, and she helps with the Hot Stove Society, and she's just an all-around good
lady. She's wonderful.
Yeah, terrific cook, great
palate. Been a guest on the show many times.
Mm-hmm, over the years. But anyway, so we're going to have a little party for Shelley coming up. Chef Terry is visiting his mother, a little surprise visit for her. Did I hear 90th birthday?
I think so, yep.
90th, but she looks like she's 70, honestly. She's so...
That's what happens when you live a delightful life in France.
When Sophia Loren said, how did you get, somebody asked her, how did you get this body? She said, it's all because of spaghetti. It's all pasta, right? And so I think it's for Terry's mom.
Cheese?
Pot de feu. That's Terry's favorite dish that she ever makes, is pot de feu, which is kind of like pot roast, right? Nice beef that's been, or tongue or whatever it is, that's been slow braised in hot broth. And so we wish her happy birthday. Chef Terry enjoying his visit over there on the west side of the country of France. And that's what I know about that.
We want to share with you a fun event happening out there. It's the farmers, producers, and chefs of Whidbey Island are passionate about what they do and where they live. At the end of the growing season, it's time to share that bounty from the land during the Whidbey Island Grown Week, a 10-day celebration of local products, services, and experiences coming up September 27th to October 6th. Learn more at WhidbeyCaminoIslands.com/Seattle Kitchen. You can also go over to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. We've posted all about it there as well. Super fun event coming up.
We have a large show for you today, despite not having Terry here. We have Chef Shota Nakajima of Adana. He's going to join us and talk about foraging. I think it's interesting, these chefs that actually go out and forage themselves. I have learned to hire foragers.
Yeah, apparently he's a fisherman, and he goes out into the forest and grabs all sorts of things, mushrooms, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and fiddleheads,
yep,
who knows what else. So it'll be fun to learn where he probably won't give us his secret spots, but I'm sure he'll give us some tips and tricks.
Yeah, those foragers, they're tight to the vest on things like where do they find those morel mushrooms or chanterelles or even the best fishing hole. We're going to bring you this week's food in the news, which includes me a bit. We're getting ready.
Big news.
I have a team back in New York right now that's doing some taste testing. We've been consulting for a bit with Nordstrom on their new restaurants in Manhattan. And so it's an exciting time. I think the 21st or 22nd is the unveiling. And then I believe the 21st is the unveiling to the press. And then the 22nd, I believe, is the opening of the store in Manhattan at 57th and 7th, or 57th and Broadway, mm-hmm, basically just a block off of
Central Park.
Yeah. And if you look, there's a building being built. I think it's the tallest residential tower in the world. And Nordstrom is in the bottom of that building. And Nordstrom's going to open. And they still haven't finished the top of the building yet. 1,500 feet tall and 100 stories. And I want to say, I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I'm going to say it anyway. We'll start a rumor.
Okay.
I think a unit just sold in this building up at the top for over $300 million for a condo.
Who bought it?
A hedge fund guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you find it interesting that a hedge fund guy could be down eating, a nice dinner in one of your restaurants?
Absolutely.
Living up in a $300 million spot.
It's not actually my restaurant. It's Nordstrom's restaurant, but they're very delicious and tasty. And one of the great things, and I'll get into this more when we talk about food in the news, but one of the great things about working with the Nordstrom team is getting an introduction to all their cooks and their chefs and their regionals.
Cool.
They are a tip-top team when it comes to running a restaurant. So I was really happy with the quality of everything that they're doing. Brittany Bartleben is going to join us from the Baker's Corner to discuss apples. We're going to get a lesson in tomato sauce. And our producer, our ex-producer, Sarah, who went on to KUOW.
Yep, she's producing the record now with Bill Radke. We miss her terribly.
Yeah, but we're going to, she went up to Kamado Islands, into the Whidbey Kamado Islands, and
she went zip lining. She went into the fields and had a delicious farm dinner, and she had a great time. So we'll get a whole
lowdown. So can you like pick wild blackberries when you're zip lining, or do you go too fast?
I think, well, it depends. I think you really go too fast and you're a little too high up, hopefully.
Wouldn't that be cool? You don't really want to zip into those bushes. They're a little dangerous. But if you're just going
maybe an apple tree, you could go by now, the top of an apple tree, snap up an apple.
And the neighbor's out there shooting at you because you're stealing their apples. And it would be an exciting time, an exciting zip. We're going to answer your culinary questions also, which is a fun little segment we do pretty much every week here on the show.
Yep.
But first, let's jump into ordinary to extraordinary.
Yes, this is a fun time when I will give you an ordinary dish and you have an opportunity to give some tips and tricks to turn it from ordinary to extraordinary. You see your list in front of you. Anything there that's sticking out that you'd like me to...
Well, pork chops.
Let's do pork chops and applesauce. Can't help it. Every time.
That Radio Disney just keeps on coming. We're all ears. Pork chops. Here's the thing.
And applesauce.
No.
Keep going.
People tend to overcook their pork chops, and I think it's because of the old trichinosis scenario, and I'm sure the health department wouldn't want me to tell you to cook them less than 165 degrees, but that's what I do when I am cooking pork at home. When you look at pork chops in the grocery store, underneath all that plastic that they're wrapped in, they look either kind of pinkish blonde, or there's some pork chops that have a dark segment of meat onto them. And that dark segment is when it's getting up towards the shoulder or the pork butt. And that dark segment is more moist, it's more fatty, it's more delicious. And so I always look for those chops that include the dark segment, or you can sometimes on the back of the T-bone, you'll see the fillet and the loin. It does pay to shop. The other thing I would say on pork chops, the thicker, the better, because then you can control the center temp and you don't dry them out as much as you. The really thin ones, it's really hard to get a brown on both sides and not overcook the center. So that's what I would say about pork chops. And I would cook them in a little bit of bacon grease. Or if your pork chops are super fatty, just cut off a little wedge of the fat on the outside, pop it into your pan and render it for your pork fat to cook your pork chop into. And then I do the same with a New York steak. If I got a little bit of extra fat on the outside of the New York steak, I'll cut it off, render it in the pan first, and then pan fry my New York steak or my pork chop in its own fat. And that way you don't have to go looking for bacon grease, or you don't have to add olive oil or butter or anything else like that. So lots of things to do. Applesauce, just cook your favorite apple. No water, no nothing. Put a lid on it and steam them down into sauce. Mm. Delicious. Okay, up next, it's questions from you, our listeners, instead of ones from Tina, our producer, on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're here with Tina Knoll and Tom Douglas. Chef Terry is in France celebrating his mother's 90th birthday. We wish them well. So what you got for me? You said you're going to post.
I like to post on our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen, and invite our listeners to ask questions. I know that you see people every day and they're at the grocery store, tap you on the shoulder.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm making some lasagna, and I had a hard time.
That's exactly what they do, too. They don't say, hey, are you Tom? Or they don't say, excuse me, Tom, would you mind answering? They just start right in.
Yeah.
God, I can never seem to cook broccoli right. What am I doing wrong? It's like, I don't know. What did you do to begin with? And so, of course, you know, that's always after they stare into my cart. They always want to see what's in my cart.
I had somebody just tell me how they followed you around the grocery store for quite some time. Uh-huh. And they were kind of hiding and they were nervous. And they knew that you at the time were probably not wanting to talk to them. They're like, he was very busy. I knew he didn't want to, but he was very gracious. And she did. She came up to you, and you were quite kind to her.
Sometimes people don't know what I'm at the store for. So, you know, a lot of times it's just like you and you, right? I'm just buying stuff for dinner.
Yeah.
Other times I have this idea for a product. And so then I go to the store to see if it's there.
Uh-huh.
And then I go to see kind of what competition level it is at.
Yeah.
And for example, the other day, maybe a month ago, Jackie made the most delicious spanakopita. Mm-hmm. And she used ruby chard instead of spinach. And it had a great sheep's milk feta, so mm-hmm. it had this unctuousness about it. It was fabulous. And so I thought, God, this would be an easy frozen product because you can just, you know, make your little triangles and pop them in a pan and sell them as a uh-huh. as a spanakopita. So I went and looked, and there were two particular brands at the Ballard Market. And one was like a artichoke and cheese, and the other was spinach and cheese made by two different companies. And one of the brands said women-owned, women workers.
Uh-huh.
And so I bought that one automatically because
nice.
I think that's
well
an
done.
Interesting area of the market right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also bought the brand that is made by the people that make the phyllo, Apollo, I think, or
mm-hmm.
something like that. And I took them out, and I tried to cook them together. The handmade one and the woman-owned one, it was literally a mess. And, you know, I was sad about that.
Which is no commentary on women.
It's no commentary on women. It's just this particular product was a mess.
Yeah.
And the Apollo one was pristine.
Mm.
So I didn't know if, you know, one was done by machine, if one was just done more carefully.
This would be a good experiment to do on the show with several different products like that.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's
kind of like our taste test, but more of sort of like functional and like, besides how's it taste, how's it hold up?
Right. But what I wanted to do was, I did, and I took a picture. I just haven't written yet, but I want to write the owners a letter saying, listen, you've got so many good things going on here. Artichoke sounded great. Your packaging was nice. I love the fact that it's a women-owned, handmade. But it looked terrible. It would have been an embarrassment to serve. I could easily have served the Apollo stuff and pretended like it was my own, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, but that's kind of what you want out of a product. You want to own
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I'm due to do that, and I mentor so many youngsters about mm-hmm. you know, business ideas, restaurant ideas, and I just want to call them and say,
I think
or
you should
write them and say, you know, I've been in this business a long time, and you guys need to. Just like this is, need
there's
to clean
some
this
tweaks.
Up a bit.
Yeah, and yeah. You're capable of. This is a fixable problem that you have,
yeah.
I'm just going to throw in some advice. You know, I have to say, as a business owner, if somebody came to me and said, you know, this radio show or these podcasts that you do, they're almost there.
Yeah,
you've got all the makings for a thing, but you got to tweak it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I would love Ira Glass to give me a call and be like, you know, you're on my radar, kid, but you got some work to do.
I took a little bit of a guess of what went wrong, which is that in my mind, they did their phyllo triangles. They didn't put enough fat in between the layers. You know how you brush it with butter. And then they didn't individually quick freeze them before they pushed them together in their little pan and then into the cardboard, you know, box and then into the freezer case. So that when you tried to pull them apart when you got them out to reheat them,
they're just,
they kind of break apart and then the layers kind of crumble. The other ones, the spanakopita ones, perfection. They just came out one by one. Mm-hmm. So I think they made those quick, you know, froze them individually and then packed them together in this perfect little tray.
All right, let's get to it. This comes from Brad Berzinski from our Facebook page. He says, this is the season for lots of wild mushrooms. They're popping up everywhere. Do you ever forage them or use them? We are going to get into that later in the show. Any preferences between chanterelles, king bolitas, or lobster? Or any of your favorite recipes? What are you doing with mushrooms this season?
It's hard because sometimes they just don't have any flavor.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm not a fan of mushrooms myself.
Really?
Yeah, and it's not great
vegan.
Because I'm vegan. I know.
You can't be eliminating things from your diet.
You're right. And I'm actually getting my head around mushrooms, and this year I am going to go full bore in and just go for it.
Here's what I would do.
Okay.
Go to the store, buy Crimini mushrooms. They're just kind of the darker brown ones, right? And then cook them or roast them until they're really almost dry.
Okay.
Mushrooms are 90% water, which is why they don't have a lot of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of roast them until they're almost dry. A little olive oil. You don't do oil either.
I'll do it. I can do it. Sometimes,
oil, salt,
yeah.
Pepper.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
kind of roast them until they're almost dry. And then eat them. And they're so much more intense and flavorful that you might decide that, yeah, I do like mushrooms.
Yeah, there is some punky.
There's
like
and a funky. It's not very good.
It's, yeah, there's that funky. There's some weird little funky thing in there that sometimes I love. It's mm-hmm. earthy and mm-hmm. that's delicious. And sometimes I'm like, wow, nope, absolutely yep. not.
So I like them for a little bit different. I think one of the best chanterelle mushroom dishes in the city is typically at Monsoon up on 12th Avenue up there or 19th Avenue.
Uh-huh.
Up on Capitol Hill, and they make a little fresh corn and chanterelle kind of saute. I love that dish. And so that's when I like chanterelles. But they have to be delicious. Sometimes chanterelles are so wet that they're just a big pile of water and they have no flavor.
Mm-hmm.
King Bolitas, I love to roast. They're so meaty. And then I actually cheat and I'll put like a veal demi or a beef demi with them at the last second. Just to kind of, it feels like roast beef. And it's really just a little bit of beef stock.
Easiest way to peel butternut squash without it slipping all over. This comes from Emily Sakuma.
Yeah. Try a peeler. Mm-hmm. You can actually use a regular peeler on it. If not, if you use a paring knife, you end up losing a lot of squash. So that's what I would try.
Ideas for Gail Craig is asking, ideas for cooking halibut besides smothering it in mayo and cheese. What?
Ooh.
Who would smother halibut in mayo and cheese?
Well, you know, halibut doesn't have a ton of flavor, and it's actually, especially if you overcook it, it's super dry. So that's why the mayo and cheese both have a lot of fat in them, so maybe that's why they're
doing
that.
I just haven't seen it like that.
But steam. You know, I'm a big steamer. I love my little bamboo steamers. I put it over an aromatic steam in the wok, so that's water, ginger root, a little garlic, a little star anise, a peel of some sort of citrus, and steam my fish right over that to 120 degrees in the center, and then pull it out and just put a little pat of butter on top or, you know, put a little olive oil or a little sesame oil, and it'd be delicious.
Yum.
Our listeners are very thoughtful.
We have 21 questions. So, if you hit our Facebook page, there's conversations, there's recipe sharing, there's all kinds of stuff going on. Just search for Seattle Kitchen.
Up next, we're going to hear from Sarah Leibovitz. She produced a piece up in the Whidbey Tomato Islands that's going to explore the fun and deliciousness of the region. Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Hey, welcome back. Our former assistant producer, Sarah Leibovitz, is going to help us out here and go on a trip up to Whidbey Camino Islands and explore the fun and deliciousness of that region. You know, they've been sponsoring our show for the last few weeks. So their big event is coming up on September 27th.
Through October 6th, it's their Whidbey Island Grown Week. It's a 10-day celebration of local products and services and super fun experiences. And Sarah got a chance to check some of those out, and she's going to bring them to us now.
All right, cool.
I sometimes find myself falling into kind of a boring routine here in Seattle. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love our city. But it's easy to fall into a pattern, to do the same thing day in and day out. To kind of forget what a magical place the Pacific Northwest really is. So, when that happens, I know it's time to take a trip outside of the city. Camano Island is all green fields, little parks and homes surrounded by oceans and trees. It's quintessential Pacific Northwest, compact into a little island just an hour car ride away from the big city. And thankfully, Christofferson Farm is easy to find, what with the directions I'd pulled up involving, like, maybe two turns the entire ride between Seattle and the farm. Perched up on a hill, it kind of reminded me of Little House on the Prairie. There are lavender fields behind it and a giant pumpkin patch that's actually shaped like a pumpkin out front. And if you look up in the trees on the side of the farm, you'll see wires running between them. Zip lines that you can take with a guide that show you the forest. There are signs along the path talking about the native flora and fauna and how Christofferson Farm works to protect them. And the best way to get a full view of the idyllic-looking farm is definitely from the trees. It makes you feel kind of isolated, like you're alone on this farm on this tiny island, even when you're zipping with a family of four kids. After that, it was time to break out the fancy clothes and head into the barn for dinner.
All right, so yeah, if you guys like, follow me.
I was amazed when I learned that the rest of the time, the barn is used as, well, just a barn. It looked so nice, with two large communal tables arranged with flowers, where the guests sit and get to know each other. All of the food served was from local farms and in season. Everything from a green salad with roasted rhubarb and hazelnuts, to salmon with a miso ginger glaze and spring peas, to the dessert of strawberry basil pavlova with a lavender balsamic reduction, was absolutely incredible. And don't worry, I've posted pictures of all of them on our Facebook page, so you can look there and be jealous. Christofferson Farm has been in the same family for generations, and it shows in the care that's gone into maintaining the farm and the land that surrounds it. I sat down with Mona Campbell, one of the siblings that runs the farm, to talk about it.
Hi, my name is Mona Campbell, and I, along with my siblings, manage Christofferson Farm.
Can you tell me a little bit about the history of Christofferson Farm?
Sure. We are so fortunate to be the fifth generation of Christoffersons here at Christofferson Farm. Our great-grandfather came from Sweden, and he bought this property in 1912, and he built an amazing dairy barn in 1914. And it's been the family ever since, and it's been an active farm and timber operation that entire time.
I got the chance to go ziplining here earlier today. When did you start doing ziplining and more activities like that? You know, that's not what you think of when you think of like an old-fashioned country farm.
It's so true. So when my generation started managing the farm, we decided that we're no longer going to lease the property to other farmers, but that we wanted to manage it ourselves. And we were thinking, what kind of business is really sustainable and in line with our mission here at the farm today? And so we came up with our mission, which is Christofferson Farm celebrates family, honors heritage, and respects the land. And so every kind of decision that we make is made with that mission in mind, and we evaluated businesses the same way. So we had been on zip lines ourselves and said, wow, this is so fun and it's amazing. And what about that as a possibility? Because it's very low impact. It exposes people to nature in a way that's fun and can be educational. We have interpretive information on our platforms, and it was a way that we could share this just amazing treasure that we have here with the public and also share our own learning of, you know, sustainable forestry and organic farming. And so it really fit our mission quite well.
That is a great mission. What else have you done to fit in with that mission here on the farm?
Well, we are certified organic, the farm. So we grow organic hay, apples, pumpkins, and lavender. And we also have undertaken several conservation efforts. We've tried to improve fish passage here because we have Christofferson Creek, which runs right through our property, and it's a salmon-bearing stream here on Kameno. And so there are a lot of efforts all along the stream corridor to improve fish passage, and we've put in a bridge to replace an old culvert, and we have actually a couple bridges, and then we've done some planting to restore the riparian forest that helps shade and shade the stream, provide woody debris, and lowers the stream temperature, all which benefit fish.
We just finished the dinner here at Christofferson Farm, and it was amazing. How did you decide to start doing these kinds of dinners? Is that a new thing?
It is a relatively new thing. You know, with the zip line business, which is a really wonderful experience, we found that people wanted to know more about the history, and they really valued the family enterprise. And we have this beautiful old National Historic Register barn. And we thought, well, you know, we can do more and we can expand the experience. And so it was really great to be able to partner with some winemakers that are regional, the some chefs that are on the island and just create these wonderful community experiences that are, you know, a way that people can appreciate fresh produce that's grown right here on the island and meet new people and, you know, hear a little bit about the wine and where it comes from. And so we thought, well, this will be another way that we can share the farm experience. For this dinner, we were really happy to have Windrose Cellars back. They're a winery out of Sequim, Washington, and we have partnered with them. This is the fourth year, and they have wonderful Italian varietal wines, and they bring what's the latest vintages, and we get to sample usually about five wines at the dinner, paired with each course. And Donna King from Kama Beach Cafe here on the island, she does the food and does a beautiful job, and also really highlights all the produce from the island. She uses things from our farm, but also from other local farms on Camino. And so together with Donna and with David and Jennifer from Windrose Cellars, we create the menu kind of, usually it's about 2 weeks before the dinner, because that's at the point at which Donna can really understand what produce is going to be available. And so she can give us an idea of what can be served. And then that combined with, you know, communicating with the winemaker, we create the menu so that it all goes together.
And for this dinner in particular, what was the produce that you wanted to make sure that you used that was in season?
Well, the peas were really amazing. And so that was one thing. They're wonderful hazelnuts locally, which are so special. Some excellent rhubarb, and the local strawberries, which is a Northwest favorite, of course. And, you know, then some wonderful herbs, all the herbs that grow so well in this area.
All right, last question. When are the next couple of dinners coming up, and where can people get tickets? Because this was amazing.
Well, our next dinner is July 14th, but I believe that one is sold out. But then we have August 18th, September 15th, and October 20th. And those are all available on christoffersonfarm.com. You know, our families just felt so privileged to be able to steward this place, and we love it, and we love sharing it. So it's a pleasure to have people out.
Christofferson Farm is a beautiful place, perfect for a summer night away from the city to regain that sense of amazement about the beauty and kindness that really exemplifies the Pacific Northwest. And even if getting back into nature is not your thing, it's worth it just to eat delicious food with great people.
Well, that's so fun to hear Sarah's voice again. I miss her on our show.
We do too.
Up next, from the plant-based movement to Heinz ketchup, we have this week's food in the news, including me on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Tina Knoll, your producer.
Exactly. Stepping in for Thierry Rotereau while he's visiting his mother in France for her surprise birthday party. It's very exciting. 90 years old is a big deal.
Yep.
Big deal.
I have this idyllic image of where Thierry is. Like, it's in a beautiful rustic farm, and there's vineyards around. And I make up a whole thing, because the way he talks so sweetly about his mother and his family and his life growing up in France, I just have a whole vision of it. It's not in a city. He may very well be like in the middle of Lyon right now, and I don't know. In my imagination, it's like the French countryside.
That's the best place to keep it, is in your imagination.
Right.
Because most likely it's just like every other house of ours.
Right?
It's got its ups and its downs.
Yep.
Food in the news, Tina. What do you know?
Well, it's really about what you know that I don't know. And this is all the chitter chatter in the New York Times. I saw a big picture of you and a big picture of Ethan Stoll. Apparently, you've got some interesting things happening with Nordstrom on the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Yeah, I would call it Midtown.
Midtown.
So 57th and Broadway. Mm-hmm. So Upper West Side is kind of 63rd and up on the west side of Central Park. So this is right in Midtown. It's kind of the old publishing area.
Mm-hmm.
And also certainly a lot of retail in that area. So, yeah, Nordstrom is opening their first store in Manhattan. as a Nordstrom. I believe they have a rack there already. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a rack over near Union Square.
Okay. And then also back in the spring, they opened their men's store, which is right across the street from this new flagship store in Manhattan. Beautiful store. It's in a building that's, I believe, the tallest residential building in the world, 1,500 feet tall. And the stories themselves are extra tall, so it's actually a 100-story building. Mm-hmm. But, like, for example, the Nordstrom stories are, you know, 20-foot ceiling. So that's two floors in a residential scenario. So anyway, so it's a very much an iconic building that's being built. Lots of
an incredible location, too, right off Central Park.
Yeah. Well, at 1,500 feet, mm-hmm. you're kind of on your own up there.
Yep.
You know, you could probably see Wasilla, Alaska, Sarah Palin, you know, if you wanted to. You could see Boston, maybe, you know, on a clear day. You know, sometimes when you're just taken off from SeaTac and it's super clear and you can see the Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier, Mount Adams, Mount Hood, all the way down to Mount Shasta I've seen before. So it is that's the kind of view you'll get at the top of the Nordstrom Tower there. They're on the first five floors. And Ethan and I kind of have a little bit of a different scenario going.
Ethan Stoll, yeah.
Yeah. Of course, he has restaurants here in Seattle, as I do. And Nordstrom wanted to have a little bit of Seattle flavor. They wanted to take a little bit of Seattle with them.
I really love that. I think it's very sweet. And it's really interesting, especially in Manhattan, where there are so many different neighborhoods and different ethnicities and different cultures represented. So it's nice that they included us.
Yes. And so Ethan chose the route of kind of having his own place there, which is, you know, Nordstrom will own and help him operate it and that sort of thing. But it's his considered what his restaurant, and so that's what his gig is. My gig is more of a culinary consultant, and so I have helped design the three concepts for them in the second floor below ground at the Nordstrom.
What are the three concepts?
So there'll be Genies, which is kind of it's a hybrid of Serious Pie, not the same pizza, but pizza, pasta, salads, sandwiches, you know, like eggplant parm and things like that. Kind of everyday Italian style food.
And now, did you name you named it Genies, or did they name it Genies?
Well, essentially, I suggested a name, and they essentially went with it.
Where'd that one come from?
Well, Jeannie Nordstrom. I have known the Nordstrom family. They've eaten in our restaurants forever, and I've been a big admirer of their service style and the customer is king style, and we will do anything for you style. And so that was always a way that I helped learn how to run my own business, is by having Bruce and Jeannie as role models in that area. And then the sons came along, and Pete and Blake and Jamie. And so it's they've been a family I've watched and imitated for a long time when it comes to how they run their business. And so Jeannie couldn't be nicer. She's like the nicest person in the world. And so when they were talking about names, and I just, you know, I'd like those kind of names. So you can tell for me, I have Lola, right? Etta's. I like that kind of name. So I said, well, what do you think about Jeannie? She's my favorite Nordstrom. I told the boys this. She's my favorite Nordstrom. I think I offended them, but no, they love her too. And so they ran it by Jeannie. Jeannie said, sure. And
nice.
She was honored. And so that's how it became Jeannie's. And then, of course, our ode to kind of the Pacific Rim influence of my cooking, certainly over the years. Look at the Dahlia menus when we first opened. I had Chinese barbecue on the menu, as you know, right next to polenta. So it's always been a favorite genre of mine. So we kind of developed a restaurant that kind of utilized some of the ingredients that you might find in the Hawaii and in a lot of Seattle restaurants, and certainly in Asia. And it's called Honey Pacific. And so that will be the other anchor restaurant on that second floor below ground. And then there's a little donut shop, and we've been running these donuts at our place at Assembly Hall.
Yeah.
Have you had them?
They're great, and it's been fun to be in Hot Stove Society, too, and see your chefs kind of experimenting and putting them together and figuring it all out.
Did a ton of testing. It's called Omochi Donut Company. It's a mochi donut. We opened maybe 6 months ago at Assembly Hall. These mochi donuts, so gluten-free, lots of dried fruit toppings on them, and different. We have a spice donut, a chocolate donut, and a vanilla donut, and then different kinds of glazes, maple, 12 spice. You know, it's a little bit unique dried banana, so crystallized freeze-dried banana in a lemon glaze on top of a spiced donut, and a little interesting combination. So that's the third concept that they are opening. And again, I'm the culinary consultant. There is some confusion out there because Ethan went one way, I went the other, and they kind of got put together as if they were our restaurants. And so the New York Times even
they put you side by side.
In the same way, which was different. But anyway, so I'm super excited. I have a team back there right now, literally today, tasting through some menus for the first time. And then I'm heading back the 20th of October for the opening.
Fun.
The press events and to do the strollabouts with the family and actually open the doors.
This
has been a long time coming, you know. So they have such cool features of this particular store. One is the outside glass walls. It's a five-story. From the street up, it's five stories Nordstrom, and the other 95 stories are residential. But the glass that they had, these glass panels that form the walls, are 20-foot tall glass panels by about, if I had to guess looking at them, maybe 8 feet wide. And so these panels were, I believe this is right, were shaped and formed in Italy, and then they're barged over to Spain because the largest glass kiln oven to kind of harden the glass is in Spain. And then they are shipped to the States in containers, and then they are put up on the side of a wall in downtown Manhattan. And, you know, to try and get big chunks of glass like that up without breaking it is an incredible feat.
Right.
I'm sure they broke a couple, but they planned on that, right? So. Very interesting store. Beautiful.
I
got to say, absolutely beautiful store.
And you know, one of the things about New York is in the Christmas time is those incredible, elaborate, you know, dressings that they do. And people just stroll on those windows displays. It'll be interesting to see what Nordstrom does for their first year in Manhattan.
Department stores used to always, you remember, you never could see in anything but the picture windows. Everything else was closed because when they always had this theory that when you're inside, they want you to be inside their store.
Focused.
They don't want you looking out. This store is just the opposite. It's got windows everywhere.
Yeah, fun.
You can look outside and be part of the Manhattan scene. So I'm excited to go be part of it, and that's our food in the news for today. Up next, we're going to make tomato sauce from scratch right here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. Thanks for hanging during that very long break. That top of the hour break, man, that's a killer.
It's a long one. It's a long one.
You know, we want to share with you a fun event happening out there. It's the farmers, producers, and chefs of Whidbey Island are passionate about what they do and where they live. At the end of the growing season, it's time to share that bounty from the land during the Whidbey Island Grown Week, a 10-day celebration of local products, services, and experiences coming up September 27th to October 6th. Learn more at whidbeycaminoislands.com/Seattle Kitchen. You can also go over to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. We've posted all about it there as well. Super fun event coming up.
That way, we just have a short segment here that we're going to talk about raw tomato sauce, or just really kind of no-cook or lightly cooked tomato sauce that is, at this time of year, you want to either use it right away. You can make pasta with fresh tomato sauce, or you can put it, you know, kind of prep it all up and then put it in the freezer and pull it out later. I'm Chef Tom Douglas. We got a large part of our show still to come here. We have Chef Shota Nakajima from Adana Restaurant on Capitol Hill. We've got Brittany Bartleben from the Baker's Corner, going to talk apples today. And, of course, our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
We're doing a twist on the trivia challenge today.
Twist. It's hard when you just have one competitor. So today, there's going to be many more.
It's you against the world today.
Many more prizes given out today because every question I get wrong, somebody wins a prize.
And an angel gets its wings.
And an angel gets its wings. Or a coconut cream pie gets its whip. So, you know, it is the 30th anniversary of the Dahlia Lounge coming up on November 15th. And we're going to have a little party. And we're going to have a coconut cream pie sale all month long. $6 a slice, which is half price. And so looking forward to kind of celebrating that. And cherishing my coworker, Shelley, who is retiring after we've been working together almost 40 years.
Wow.
We started as line cooks at Cafe Sport in the Pike Place Market, where Etta's is now, almost 40 years ago. I want to say 37 or something like that. So
It's a pretty super, wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's super exciting for her, and she's been waiting all this time for her Medicare to kick in, and it kicks in October 1st. So
the last days.
October 1st. She's a sweetheart, and she is the one who dreamed up the triple coconut cream pie so many years ago that has become ubiquitous here in Seattle and has raised, I will tell you, millions of dollars for charity. We have often donated that pie over the 30 years it's been on the menu. People spend lots and lots of money for it.
Well, it's worth every penny. It's a delicious pie.
Yeah, the dessert dashes and stuff. Okay, tomato sauce. Yep. This is an area I think is kind of interesting because I think people have not quite the understanding of how useful a box grater is, right? You know what a box grater is, Tina?
Yeah, it's steel kind of, and it's got different types of grating on each side. So
different size holes
in it, yeah.
Grate against. I like them because they're steady when you put your hand on the top. You can steady them, and the ones that have a little bit of a rubber foot, I think, are the best.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like them because you can rip the heck out of your hands, right?
Yeah,
you just shred your knuckles easily, or if you're getting down to an end piece and you kind of put it in your palm, you can. If your palm's not tough.
Yeah.
Like if it does not have a lot of callus, you can cut right into your palm. And so,
got to be careful.
What I do like them for is cheese, number one. Number two is Jackie, my wife, when she makes biscuits or shortbreads or things like that where you need cold butter, she puts the butter in the freezer and then grates the butter on the box grater. And
that's a pro tip right there.
Well, it is a pro tip because so often you put it in big chunks, and by the time you get your fingers into it and work it down to what they always say, like pea size or even smaller, right? Then it's too warm.
Mm-hmm.
So this, you just grate it in, mix it with the flour, boom, right back in the freezer. You put the whole bowl with the butter back in the freezer with the flour, right? But now what we're talking about is tomatoes, a quick tomato sauce. So you take a nice ripe tomato. And the riper it is, the easier it is to do this. If it's not super ripe, then you might grate the skin in with it, which isn't the end of the world. There's nothing wrong with eating tomato skin. It does look funnier in the sauce. But if you have a ripe tomato and you hold it in the palm of your hand and you kind of rub it against the large section of the grater, the tomato skin will just kind of come right away, and the meat and the pulp of the tomato will grate off into the grater.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with this beautiful, fresh tomato sauce that you can, at this point, either cook or not cook. Because a lot of people eat raw these days, right? So
let me ask you something, because it seems like if you're grating it on there, it's going to get all runny and everywhere. You're going to, how do you capture all the stuff?
You just grate over a bowl.
Right inside a monster bowl.
And if you feel like it's too wet, you simply just strain off some of that tomato water. And what do we do with that on this show?
You use it somehow.
Tomato water martini.
Of course, water martini.
You just simply
perfect.
Take that tomato water, the extra water that you have, and you simply add vodka or tequila, and you have a tomato water margarita or tomato water martini.
Yum.
It's so delicious, and that's what you do while you're making the rest of your pasta sauce.
That sounds like a lovely evening.
Need something. You can't go right into Chianti.
No.
You have to have a little something beforehand.
What are we listening to while we're making this and drinking our martini and grating our...
Claudio Villa.
Okay.
Or Villa is probably the way it's pronounced. And he is the ultra falsetto on Big Night.
Perfect.
The soundtrack for the movie Big Night.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my idea of getting ready for dinner right there.
So, all right. And Claudio, you're making some fresh, delicious tomato sauce.
Yes. So then you just take that tomato sauce, you take your garlic, and you do on the small grate exactly the same thing. You just grate your garlic, you chop your basil, and then you put in your hot pasta. And that cooks it enough for what you want. And you've got a no-cook, two-minute tomato, basil, garlic sauce for pasta. And
how many tomatoes do you say?
Salt and pepper.
You think two big tomatoes, one big tomato?
Well, what were we cooking for, Tina?
Oh, that's right. We are cooking for me and Julia Childs.
Yeah.
So she's very hungry. So how many tomatoes for her?
Medium-sized tomato per person.
Okay.
For a pasta sauce.
Okay.
That would be my guess. That same thing could be served in a soup bowl as gazpacho, right? Like a little tomato soup, fresh raw tomato soup. But that is the way to kind of just get away from the no-cook method of pasta sauce. If you want to take those very same tomatoes, cut them in half, put them meat side down onto a charcoal grill, and just give them a quick char, the sugars in the tomato will caramelize, and now you have a charred tomato sauce with a little bit of smokiness to it for your pasta sauce.
Yum.
Just super same simple. You can just put it right on the grater, the hand grater, and just be done with it. it just doesn't get much easier.
Yeah.
And this is the time of year when those tomatoes are going to have to start coming off the vine, right? They're, as the days get shorter, they won't ripen up anymore, and you'll be picking your green tomatoes, which you can make green tomato jam and preserve them and fry green tomatoes. But we're getting to that point where we're transitioning from being able to ripen a tomato to getting to the spot where you just have to pick them green and utilize them that way.
So. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And don't forget, you can braise. Like, you can do a lamb shank with green tomatoes, right? Green tomatoes have a nice acidity. They cut through the richness of the lamb. So you can braise them like a vegetable in with mm-hmm. your other ingredients. So
yum. Sounds delicious.
Exactly. Right. Can't wait. Up next, it's Shota Nakajima from the Capitol Hill restaurant Adana, A-D-A-N-A, right here in the Seattle kitchen at Large Studios on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. Happy to be back here in the studio today, since we're not at the Hot Stove Society. Chef Shota Nakajima from Adana Restaurant is here up on Capitol Hill. What is... Pine Street, Pike Street, I forget.
I'm on 15th and Pine.
15th and Pine. There you go. Welcome to the show.
Nice to meet you.
Have you been on before?
I haven't. So thank you for inviting me.
We took our whole group there, I want to say, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I actually remember that. Yeah.
It's good fun. Really delicious. Tell us about your foraging adventures. It's that time of year. You know, people are thinking about huckleberries and porcini mushrooms and
greens, everything.
So tell us, you like to forage. What got you into that? Is that a family tradition?
It's more of a tradition. I started kind of with the cooks in the restaurant because we're Wednesday through Sunday, dinner only, and we have Monday, Tuesdays off. So Monday, Tuesdays, we all try to do something at least once a month, not every week, so we don't drive each other crazy. But once a month or so, we try to go foraging or go fishing or something like that. And I was like, okay, let's try doing more things. And the first time we went, we ended up finding chanterelles, and it was a lot of fun. And we ended up going all the time, like sometimes before service or a quick run.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are they that close?
There's some close spots. There's some really, really close spots. Like this year, my first run, I was out for maybe an hour and a half before service, and I came back with 10 pounds of chanterelles.
Crazy.
And a few lobster mushrooms.
Not like Volunteer Park or anything that close.
No, not that close. A little bit more further out. But, yeah, I mean, this year in general, it's been a really, really good year. Like, morels, I came back with buckets. Chanterelles are just popping all over the place. Mm-hmm. It started early. So, excited to see how long they're going to go for this year, though, just because they started so early.
Mm-hmm. What should people look for if they want to find a special spot to find good mushrooms? Do you like... recently burned areas? Do you like just clearings near pine trees? You know, what do you look for when it comes to a good spot?
It depends. I guess it depends on what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. Like morels, you want it to be burned areas mm-hmm. for the main part because they get the nutrition from ashes. Porcinis, I don't know. It's all kind of different. It's like a gut thing, too.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you want places where they have a lot of mycelium mm-hmm. under the dirt. So if you dig around a little bit and you see all those white little strings, those are mycelium. So if you see those, you're in the right area. Hmm. And you want to make sure the ground's damp and it's not frozen yet, because when it freezes, it kind of stops everything. Yeah. So,
and it's all legal. You can disturb the earth in national parks, and you're allowed to do all that. I don't know, honestly. I'm not a forager.
I don't know.
Yeah. As long as you're not killing deer off season or something of that nature.
No, I mean, it's just mushrooms.
Mushrooms is fine.
Yeah.
And then are the clippable greens still out there, like the woodruff and things like that? Is that?
Yeah, there's some. I don't know what's out right now, actually. A lot of them have gone pretty bitter or hard at this mm-hmm. point. But green-wise, I do love spring greens a lot. Mm-hmm. Spring greens, I know we're supposed to talk about fall greens, but spring greens, there's just a lot, like miner's lettuce, devil's club, fiddleheads, just everything's all around. And I mean, fiddleheads, like ferns are all over the place, so it's one of the easiest things to just get pounds and pounds of.
Yeah, that's one of those ones, man. I just have never developed a taste for those fiddlehead ferns. I don't know what it is about it. I remember years ago at Cafe Sport when I was, for all the foragers, this is our early 80s, would come to the door, whether they had a half a veal to sell or I remember Warren Webster, the wild huckleberry man, come in with his 80-year-old guy with his purple-stained fingers, and every time he would say, wow, the bears were thick out there today. So huckleberries, it seems to be everyone's favorite, whether it's huckleberry shake or anything like that. Do you ever forage for huckleberries? Are they hard to do? Are we past the season at this point?
I don't think we're past the season. I will honestly say I haven't found huckleberries or huckleberry spots on my own, so that's kind of a harder one. But, yes, I do love huckleberries and use it in my restaurant, too.
Do you?
Yeah.
Good. So you don't mind buying foraged ingredients from others? You don't have to.
No. I'm not at all. Like, I mean, to sustain the restaurant, if I had to forage everything, that would be crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have, like, my foraging people, like Forage and Found, Mushroom Joe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are the main guys I buy my mushrooms from. But, yeah, I mean, for myself, I kind of go more for the purpose of kind of appreciating for the guest. Appreciation for the ingredients itself. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, we get it in a box, but we just walked around for 2 hours and this is how much we just got.
Mm-hmm.
Don't throw the scraps away.
Mm-hmm.
Don't waste anything. You can dehydrate them, use it in a stock, use them later, use them on a special menu or something. And that's kind of the mentality that I learned the most out of. Wait, I learn a lot about, and my cooks hopefully learn a lot about, and I like to talk about that a little bit after we go foraging and whatnot, just because, hey, if we're going to spend 2 hours of time, let's learn something about it.
Right. You know, we have a farm in eastern Washington, in Prosser, Washington, and when our teams come over to the farm, you know, you learn so much, right? They learn a lot. Many have never have been on a farm before. Many have never even seen a chicken in a coop before, much less cut one up and, you know, all that. They've cut them up plenty, but they haven't seen them live. But they go out and pick, they plant, they weed, they do all those things. But one of the cool things about that is the sharing of the meal afterwards. We all cook dinner together, we sit down together, and you learn so much more about your teammates in the restaurant that I would imagine foraging, you do the same thing.
It's foraging.
Getting the food is only half the fun.
Yeah. Yeah, like this year, one of my favorite trips that I did with a team was we went out and we were like, oh, let's go for morels. And we found a few morels. And then we ended up on this porcini patch where we ended up finding 7 or 8 pounds of porcinis. Just beautiful, gorgeous porcinis.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Fish Lake. We fished some fish up and dinner time. I mean, we went out on a Monday, so we all just ended up crashing there till Tuesday. But we ate all the porcinis, all the morels that we got and the fish and, you know, just drank wine and drank whiskey and chilled out and talked and hung out and, you know, just got the team a little bit closer together.
Yeah, those are life experiences they'll never forget.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
At least that's been my experience.
Yeah.
With that, so. When you go out fishing, you have your favorite fish toll you're going to share with us, with our listeners?
I'm not a hardcore fisher. I just like going out there and standing in awe with a fishing pole.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times I'll just go by Lake Washington, get perch or something. I don't really eat those, to be honest, but it's more of a catch and release just for fun. I do like throwing crab pots if I can, digging for clams if I can. But hardcore fishing is kind of hard just because getting a boat and all that's a whole entire experience. So,
do you know Keith Robbins? He's got Spot Tail Salmon Guide and he's got a little bar on Capitol Hill called Hula Hula.
Yes, I have heard of it. I don't know him himself, but...
Yeah, he's a fisherman, too. He doesn't catch anything.
Okay.
Yes, Keith, I just said that on the air.
Yeah.
no, just kidding. But, he does salmon guiding every day out in the Sound, and I am not a fisher person.
Yeah.
So many people have the patience for it. I would much rather be on the golf course, you know, swinging away or something like that. I don't have the patience. I like what you said, the awe of it, right?
Yeah.
It's just being out there in nature.
Yeah, kind of the same, like, reason I go mushroom foraging all the time, to, like, just get away from the city.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why, like, farms and all those places are kind of cool. Just getting out of the city, relaxing, just because we all work in Capitol Hill, pretty much all live in Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just waking up and walking around where it doesn't, you know, smell like a million people.
Yeah, it just smells like bears.
Yeah, just bears.
Elk.
Just nothing. Water, chilling, relaxing, just taking it in and taking it out.
We had this critter coming by the farm, the sliding door at the farm by our bedroom, and it would wake the dog up, and we didn't know what it was. We thought it was a bear, but it stunk like crazy. I mean, literally stunk, and it was putrid. And turns out it was a badger.
Huh.
That was getting everybody all riled up and leaving lots of big scat piles for us. And we went on Google to find out what kind of critter it was by looking at the scat. And I felt like a Boy Scout out there.
Yeah.
It was pretty darn fun.
I don't think
Okay, tell people again where your restaurant is and where they could maybe taste some of these delicious mushroom concoctions that you come up with.
My restaurant's Adana up on Capitol Hill. It's on 15th and Pine, two blocks down from the Trader Joe's, a block down from... The co-op is always how I like to explain
That's
it.
How people find you. Well, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. So up next, it's Brittany Bartleben, pastry chef from the Dahlia Bakery, Dahlia Lounge. And we're going to talk apples today on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Hey, it's Chef Tom Douglas, and we are into the Baker's Corner. On Cairo Radio, Seattle Kitchen Show. My guest is Chef Brittany Bartleben, a pastry chef of the Dahlia Lounge and the Dahlia Bakery. And we're in her kitchen. We don't often get to come over to her private space over here. But she's got a beautiful baking kitchen. At least I think it's beautiful. I built it. Efficient, I'll say. Yeah. And today we're going to talk about utilizing summer stone fruits in the baking world. Maybe you even have some savory ideas. But summer stone fruits... And I'll say, last week, I told people that I snuck into the bakery. Jackie, my wife, told me that my daughter's new in-laws were coming to dinner. She told me at 4 o'clock, and they were coming at 6 o'clock, and I had to figure out dinner for 6. So I got the dinner part figured out. She and I figured out the dinner part. We made a salmon niçoise salad, super delicious. She had just brought over a ton of different produce from the Prosser Farm. We had green beans, cucumbers, different lettuces, tomatoes. We had the first of the ripe paprika peppers. If you've never had the real thing they make paprika out of, they are thick-walled, and they roasted up beautifully, and they were so delicious. I had never had one before, like a fresh one compared to the powdered paprika. So we had that, new potatoes that she has just dug, green beans, and I had got some Copper River silver salmon. So we had a great niçoise salad. But I did not have time to make dessert, so I snuck into the Dahlia Bakery, and I found this cake. And, you know, we're going to talk about stone fruits today, and this is a master class in stone fruits.
That was our seasonal coffee cake that you had, which really, it's a cake. It's, let's be honest, a coffee cake is a cake. You can eat it for breakfast. You can eat it for dessert. And it was a pistachio olive oil cake. That I treated like an upside-down cake, meaning I fanned out some apricots on the bottom of my cake pan and then poured my cake batter over that. I skipped the caramel layer that typically goes in an upside-down cake just because I didn't need that extra layer of sweetness. I just love pistachios and stone fruit. It's a really, really great combination. Works with cherries, plums, apricots, peaches. So that was just sort of a no-brainer for me, and I'm glad you liked it.
So it's basically a classic upside-down cake.
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting about the cake, I have this favorite cake, and it's even in the Dahlia Bakery cookbook, that when I opened Cuoco, our Italian restaurant, I had it on the menu as one of the desserts, but everyone sent it back because it was too dry. And it was just, in my mind, I've been to Piemonte many times, the town of Alba. You know, if you drive around that area of Italy, you drive around a million miles of hazelnut trees. It's hazelnuts are their life, and outside of truffles. But anyway, so I had your cake, and it really reminded me of this kind of dense hazelnut cake that I love with a shot of espresso. It didn't need the fruit on top, but it was delicious. But those nut cakes like that, can you make those out of anything? Like, for example, do they have to have white flour? Can they be gluten-free flours, nut flours? Can that just have been a pistachio nut flour cake?
I would think... You need a little bit of flour. You can make it gluten-free, but so I would use that that cup-for-cup blend that I really like, or any sort of gluten-free blend. Anytime I do a nut cake like that, I do include a little bit of nut flour. That was a pistachio cake, so I, rather than buying pistachio flour, which would be really expensive, I just finely ground some pistachios, and I snuck in a little bit of flour to my food processor so it didn't get gummy. And I also used a little bit of pistachio paste to pump up that pistachio flavor. So, and yeah, I can see how it could be like that Piedmontese hazelnut cake. I know exactly which cake you're talking about. I personally love that cake. I don't think it's dry at all. It's delicious.
I think it's just a vehicle for whipped cream.
Absolutely, yeah. It's ice cream, or I agree. I guess we're getting a little off stone fruit topic.
Okay, go ahead. So that was apricot. Uh-huh. So you've and you could put that. I know I got off on that. So I just love that cake.
It's so good.
So let's go back to peach upside down. Like there's a recipe for that in my Big Dinner book that I love making. I take a little ramekin, put the caramel sauce in the bottom. I put a whole half a peach. Does that make sense?
It does, yes.
Okay, a whole half a peach, all peeled and ready to go. Oh, you can hear what just finished over there.
That's my corn.
What are you baking with that?
So I'm going to strip the kernels off of that, and I'm going to make a sweet corn custard for my honey cake that I just put on the menu tonight that we're serving with fresh berries. So, yeah.
Okay, back to my peach upside down.
Yes.
So that could have been a plum. That could have been a peach. Could have been an apricot. It could have been an apple.
Yes.
You know, honestly. So I love an upside down cake. They all kind of come off of that kind of a pineapple upside down cake. What are some variations of that you would use to make that more interesting?
Well, my hands-down absolute favorite upside-down cake is a plum upside-down cake because of the color, because of the tanginess from the plums, and because of how beautifully it pairs with a really nice brandy or a cognac. So I slip a little bit of cognac into that caramel sauce and a little bit into my cake batter as well. So I use cognac instead of vanilla extract, and it just marries beautifully with the plums. And that's my favorite upside down cake. And I love stone fruits for upside down cake in particular. So,
you know, cognac is often aged in wood, sometimes not, but sometimes it's so that vanillin from the wood oak might give you a little bit of that vanilla flavor. Right. So you don't have to spend all that money on the vanilla
exactly.
Right now. In an upside-down cake, is there a trick to make sure that the fruit and the caramel doesn't stick to the bottom of your ramekin?
We use parchment paper, so we will actually cut a little circle of parchment to fit snugly inside that ramekin. So we've talked about pan spray before, so you can use Pam or any, you know, brand. So you'll spray your ramekin and then set your parchment paper inside and then spray it again. And so that, it's kind of foolproof. It will not stick to the ramekin. So, yeah.
That is a super trick because so often you're kind of like doctoring, right, the caramel back onto it or half the fruit stuck to the bottom of your ramekin. Having that parchment, now when you pull that parchment off, you turned it out, you got the parchment on top. Do you have to take it off when it's super hot?
Not super hot. You want to let it cool 10 minutes. You don't want to burn yourself, but you want it to still be warm. And it peels off beautifully. I do spray that parchment one more time before I put my caramel and my fruit down, just as a little insurance. But yeah, I've not had any trouble with that method. So it's a really good home trick as well.
Are you okay, now we've got an upside down plum cake.
Uh-huh.
Are you an ice cream girl or a whipped cream girl?
Either. I'll take either. Yeah. It kind of just depends on if I have a bunch of ice cream on other areas of my menu. If I'm serving it at home, I like ice cream just because.
I'm totally whipped cream.
Yeah. Are you?
I'm totally whipped cream. I don't know. I'm not the biggest ice cream person. Unless I'm eating a pint of it. Then I'll just sit there and eat the whole darn thing.
Shame you to find of ice cream.
But, you know, you always hear of cake and ice cream for a birthday. It's, like,
yeah.
It's just not my thing.
Yeah.
I much prefer whipped cream. It's literally the same ingredients except without the egg, right? Sugar and cream.
Yeah.
But I like the way whipped cream kind of spreads around the cake without it having its own kind of separate texture from the cake.
What about pie?
Pie.
Fruit pie.
Total ice cream guy on pie. So my theory doesn't stand then, does it?
You know, we all like what we like.
Yeah, total ice cream guy on pie. Okay, stone fruit and pie.
Love stone fruit pies. And in fact, plum pie. Plum pie is delicious. And again, who knew? I add a little Armagnac to my plum pies. Apricot pie is super delicious. We've got those in the bakery right now. I mean, who doesn't love a peach pie? If you're going to make a peach pie, I believe I've talked about this before, invest in one of those serrated peelers. They work so much better than having to... Well, I'm not going to say it works better. It's just easier and more efficient than having to boil your peaches.
Blanch. It only takes 30 seconds to blanch them.
I don't know, it's hot out. I don't want to get a pot of water out. I'd rather just peel. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you, for me, like on a peach pie, I love adding, some, they're so sweet, right? Sometimes peaches around here are so sweet, they just drip with melted sugar almost, right? I like adding something to kind of challenge that sweetness, like black pepper or maybe a little cayenne pepper or something to kind of like fight back a little bit against the sweetness of the peach. What do you think about that?
I think I'm going to try that. That's interesting. My thing is just let the peach be the peach, but I add very little sugar. For my peach pie, I believe I add two tablespoons of sugar and plenty of lemon juice.
For a 9-inch pie.
For a 9-inch pie, correct. Yeah. Yeah, you don't really... First of all, they also have plenty of pectin in them, too. So you don't need to add any... Well, not any, but you don't need to add much thickener. So you're letting those peaches be the beautiful, perfect fruit that they are. So, yeah.
Are you a pie... What is it? It's not really a pie plate. What's a pie container called?
A pie dish or... Yeah.
A pie pan girl? Are you a rustic tart, girl?
I'm a pie pan girl. So I grew up, like, one of the first things that drew me to the kitchen was watching my grandmother make those pies and watching her crimp the shell. I'd always request a peach pie for my birthday, and she'd be like, well, I can't get them until I find my little peach man, this guy that sold them on the side of the road. So I do hold a very special place in my heart for just a classic double crust, normal pie, fruit pie.
Yeah, I'm a rustic dude. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for coming.
Next time we'll see you in the Seattle kitchen at the Baker's Corner when we're over at the Hot Stove Society. We're on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. For the first time in our history, we're solo.
Yeah.
Chef Terry has abandoned us for his mother.
Yep.
In the southwest of France.
Yep. So it's just you and me, and I can't answer any trivia that has to do with food. So I will be asking you a bunch of questions. So, how should we do it?
I think we should do it like this. Every question I get wrong, I'm going to give away a whole... Well, people can decide whether they want a 6-inch or the regular 9-inch pie.
Everyone's going for the 9-inch.
Well, not really, because some people just are two people, and the pie does not hold. Once you cut into it, it does not hold.
And what we're talking about here is the coconut, the famous coconut cream pie that you can get at the Dahlia Bakery. You can buy a whole one there.
It's what started the Dahlia Bakery, honestly. That's why we opened the bakery, was that pie. We decided to serve it in the regular 9-inch, a 6-inch size for two. And then we have little pie bites.
Those pie bites
pop into your mouth.
It's like biting a cloud. That's what I've always said. When you and I first started working together, I think it was my 28th birthday. You came into the Cairo studios and brought me a whole pie, a whole coconut cream pie, and I think it was the 9-inch. And I barely shared it. I might have given maybe a quarter of it away to the newsroom.
That was before you were vegan,
Right, right. Now, nope. It's not happening. So the origins of that pie, how did that whole thing come about? Because it really is a famous pie at this point.
Our very first Dahlia menu, I wanted it to be a little bit homey, and we wanted to start with starches. I was just back from Italy, and I was enamored with all the different starches out there. So the whole menu started like, it wasn't veal osso buco with polenta. It was polenta with veal osso buco. It was a lup chung fried rice with Chinese barbecue duck, so everything on the menu, it was a very homey, starchy forward, and I wanted some homey desserts to go with it. And so I had a friend named Jim Dodge who had written a book called The Great American Baker, and we had done a few events around the country together, and he had given me this book, and I said, I want something to Shelley, my baker at the time. I said, I want something like this. This is what I think of the Dahlia dessert to look like, a strawberry shortcake, maybe a coconut cream pie, real homey style desserts. And so we took the pie as an inspiration, made it our own, as we often do in books, right? Added the triple part of the pie to it, I think it was Jim that put the coconut in the crust. It might have been us. Mm. We added the triple somewhere into it, but there's coconut in the crust, coconut in the custard, and then certainly shaved toasted coconut on top of the pie. And it became our triple coconut cream pie. And that hominess really hit with people, and it became our most famous dish. Between that and the lobster pot stickers, it became our most famous dish at the Dahlia Lounge. And to this day, it's available in most all of our restaurants. It's still our number one selling dessert, and it's spawned the bakery. And I'm most proud is that we donate it sometimes for events. And
you know, we donate something for an event every day of the year. And so sometimes it's a pie, sometimes it's dinner for two, you know, whatever that happens to be. But the pie is a unique animal in that it has raised, we think, if we do our math correct, almost $2 million for charity in the 30 years we've been making this pie and giving it away. And
so people use it like as auction, like exactly. Dessert dash type.
Yep. And, you know, where it really makes money at these dessert auctions is that it's pretty well known and people bid up on it. And then somebody will buy it for like $500 and then they'll donate it back because they know there's other people in the audience that wanted it. So,
yeah,
you know, it could raise, I've seen that pie raise $100,000.
Nice.
But, you know, it's typically really great. It can raise anywhere from $500 to $5,000. So it's pretty fun.
It's very delicious. All right. So the way we'll do this, I'll ask you questions, 10. Well, should we say 10? And then when you get one wrong, somebody gets a pie.
Yes.
And how about we, I will just.
You can choose. Like I said, if you don't be wasteful. If you, just two of you. We'll give you the
9-inch
pie,
or the 6.
And if you got a family, we'll give you the 9-inch pie.
And I will do a, I'll choose randomly from people that have asked questions on our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. Is that fair?
Sure. Do whatever you want.
All of my friends get a pie.
And for the month of November, by the way, the pie will be on sale in all of our restaurants for $6 a slice, which is half price from what it normally is. So.
Okay, are you ready?
Yes.
Your first question. In Latin, what does mala mean in so far as a food item?
What, do you just want to give away pies?
You're
today?
Welcome, audience.
I'm just going to say honey.
Apple. One person gets a pie.
There's one pie.
Okay, what does red velvet cake get its red color from?
Well, it depends if it's artificial or not. So I would say red dye number 14, 16, 18, or beets.
Crushed beetles.
Oh,
it
crushed
says
beetles.
Crushed beetles.
Right.
Is that really?
That. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, who does that?
The originator of the red velvet. Nobody does that anymore, I don't think.
No. Mung bean sprouts are usually the sprouts used in what type of cooking?
Chinese cooking.
Correct.
No pie
no
for you.
No pie for you. Nuts are the most common what?
Allergen.
Wow.
Ooh,
nice.
No pie for
wow,
you.
Wow, no pie for you. Farina is Italian word for what?
Flour. No pie for
jeez
you.
Jeez Louise. All right, you guys, I'm going to go for harder here. Let me.
Well, I've only given away two pies so far.
Okay, number 6 for you. On what vegetable did an ancient Egyptian place his right hand on when taking an oath?
I'm going to say an onion.
Wow, correct. No.
Yes.
No pie for you.
No pie for you. How about that, huh?
Well, here's one for you.
Abigail is just looking over like, how'd you know that?
That was a good one. All right, here's one for you. How many flowers are in the design stamped on each side of an Oreo cookie?
52.
Nope. 12. Oh. Somebody gets a pie. All right. Question number 8. What are the two top-selling spices in the world?
I'm gonna say cinnamon. Am I already wrong?
Already wrong. You want to keep trying?
Sure. cinnamon is not right, so then I'm going to say things like paprika considered a spice, you suppose?
Not one on this list.
Okay. So black pepper?
But a good question. Yep. Pepper's one.
Mm-hmm. And not cinnamon. I'll say clove.
It's actually mustard. All right. 4 people will receive a pie so far, and 4 people will not receive pies. Your next question. What is the most widely eaten fish in the world?
Tuna.
Herring.
Oh, that's a pie for you.
Pie for you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pies. Your very last question. What American city produces most of the egg rolls sold in grocery stores in the United States? I mean, this
I'll say
seems
Los Angeles.
Really hard. No.
No?
It's a weird one. It's a really weird one.
San Luis Obispo.
No.
Modesto.
No, not in that state.
Newark, New Jersey. San Antonio, Texas.
It's a city in Texas.
Well known for their Chinese spring rolls.
Oddly, Houston, Texas.
Houston.
Apparently, they're just cranking them out over there. And mm-hmm.
So how many pies do I give away?
6 pies.
All right, we're going to call out the names of people that had sent in questions on our Facebook page, and we're going to call out the names, and you will know that you'll be getting called from Abigail or texted or something and to find out if you want a 6-inch or a 9-inch pie in honor of our 30th anniversary at the Dahlia Lounge.
Beverly Kidd is asking a great question about onions on our Facebook page. Beverly Kidd, you get a pie. Lori Dragseth, you also get a pie. Gail Craig is asking all about cooking halibut. Gail Craig, you get a pie. Michael Sinan, He's really got a lot of questions about Scotch eggs. And Michael Sinan gets a pie. And Brad Berzinski, we answered his questions about mushrooms earlier today on the show. Brad, you also get a pie.
So Michael and Brad, that's five. And I believe we have one more pie to give away.
How about Shannon Morrison?
All right. Shannon Morrison gets a pie. Congratulations to you all. I'm sorry to the ones where I answered them correctly. Not sorry. And remember, if you want to be part of our show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. This show is produced by Large Media, L-A-R-J Media, and our sound engineer is Sean Doncomi del Torre, our production assistant, Abigail Leong, who couldn't get up this morning. And special thanks to our guest, all the folks at Hot Stove Society, Nina, Janet, Nils, for helping out. If you want to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen. Thanks for listening.